Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we are chatting about Olivier Assayas's new film, Personal Shopper. And joining me in the studio is the extremely personable Daniela Verrick-Tanidi and the personally shocking Harry Chapman. Hello to you both.
Hello.
How are we doing?
Yeah, not bad.
I'm not okay with that introduction.
Would you rather you were personable?
Yes,
I couldn't call Danny personally shocking.
I'm not shocking at all.
Yeah, with the beard as it is, Harry, I think we can call you shocking.
I think so.
All right. So this week, as I said, it's Olivier Assayas's new film, Personal Shopper, which finds Christian Stewart as a celebrity's PA shopping assistant, but also she's a psychic and is trying to get over the death of her brother and communicate with him through the afterlife, as well as dealing with the most dramatic eye messaging that has ever been put to film.
Yeah.
But let's start with, as usual, our podcast pitch. So this week I wanted to ask you guys, this film is called Personal Shopper, but the actual shopping for the celebrity is maybe not the key characteristic of the film. So if you were to make a film about the relationship between a celebrity and their shopper and just going around and shopping, who do you think would be the most interesting film? Pitch me that film. Danny.
So recently I watched Lost Soul, the doomed journey of Richard Stanley's The Island Dr. Moreau.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought it was really entertaining, and I thought it would be really cool to have a personal shopper for Marlon Brando and just see them interacting, because he's like a very interesting character and very specific about what he wants.
Yeah, yeah. And is this specific Moreau Brando or any Brando?
Any Brando.
Great. I want pre-apocalypse now Brando.
Yeah.
I want going to the donut shop multiple times a day Brando.
Yeah, that would be fun.
And I want it to be Stan Mikita's donuts from Wayne's World.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah, that could be a really interesting insight into Brando, because when you actually look at someone's shopping bag, you can learn so much about them. And if you didn't necessarily go into his relationships and family life that much and just stayed on the aspect of Marlon Brando shopping and what he buys, that would be really, really interesting.
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
Yeah. Harry?
So, my pick, have you seen that recently for Comic Relief, Love Actually is coming back together?
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, Emma Thompson has decided not to do it, understandably, because of what happened with Alan Rickman. But I'd like to give her a standalone film as her character from Love Actually, where she gets rid of the kids, she runs away, runs to New York, and gets herself a young, handsome personal shopper with a very nice beard. I don't know who would be cast as that. I'm going to let other people...
Very nice, very kind of raggedy, unkempt beard, maybe.
Maybe. And then she almost becomes the sort of Emma Thompson we know in real life, who wears sort of like, you know, snake skin trousers on chat shows and is crazy And then maybe she falls in love with the personal shopper.
I don't know. I think the personal shopper might be in love with her, but it's maybe not reciprocated.
No, I think it's definitely reciprocated.
I don't think it is reciprocated.
I think her character falls in love with the personal shopper and they live happily ever after. And no one mentions the age difference.
And then the personal shopper has an affair with someone at an office party. And maybe buys a necklace.
No, we don't just have... It doesn't just repeat itself. She breaks the cycle with the personal shopper.
Oh, okay, all right.
And he's also has great fashion sense. And definitely doesn't wear T-shirts with just, you know, just animals on them all the time.
Well, it's a style staple of this personal shopper, whoever that personal shopper may be.
Whoever that personal shopper is, he's got great taste.
Right, for my choice, I'm going for Patrick Stewart as my celebrity. Mm. And my shopper is James McAvoy.
Okay.
And it's done in a mock doc way in that Patrick Stewart knows that it's a mockumentary, but James McAvoy doesn't. And what? Patrick Stewart is leading James McAvoy into like trying to make him get more into character to take over the role of Professor X now that Patrick Stewart's done with it. And I just want to do it in a kind of Ashton Kutcher punked way, in that Patrick Stewart will kind of lead McAvoy into something like Selfridges and go up to counters and be like, oh, I my friend, he needs some hair removal cream, and Patrick Stewart kind of actually putting hair removal cream on James McAvoy's head in the middle of Selfridges and just making him wait there until he can just shave his head in the middle of the shop, and doing loads of these things as James McAvoy gets more and more confused.
So why does James McAvoy stay for this?
Because he's a serious actor, and if Patrick Stewart is giving you an acting lesson, no matter how insane it is, you're going to stay, aren't you?
Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think like the role is vacant now, isn't it? I think he needs to do it. He needs to step up. He needs to go full Stewart.
Full Stewart.
So yeah, McAvoy is my shopper to Stewart's celebrity. That's my pitch. Right. Who's getting funding this week?
I'm going for Jake's.
Oh, that's nice.
Sorry.
I was going to go for Danny's.
I was going to go Brando as well, because it actually sounds like a plausible thing.
Yeah, it sounds like a thing rather than a man falling in love with someone.
Yeah, I mean, I think and that new trend of biopics not really being biopics, but finding a little moment in people's lives to get some insight on them. And I feel like Shopping with Brando coming 2018.
Hashtag retitle.
Yeah, that sounds good. I'm looking forward to that. Yeah. Right, so... all of that talk about personal shoppers sounds like we should maybe talk about something. So, Olivier Assayas's Personal Shopper, which is out now. It's got Kristen Stewart as we mentioned, as a shopper for a celebrity, but also dealing with the death of her brother and perhaps trying to communicate with him in the afterlife. I really love this film. I saw it last year at London Film Festival. I got up quite early to watch it. It was on at something like 8:30 in the morning, and I remember reading coverage of it when it premiered at Cannes, but I didn't want to read too much about it, so I kind of had a rough idea of what the reception was, but not a huge idea of what it really was about. And so I'm in there at 8:30, I'm a bit tired, and I can't quite remember what I'm in for. And then you've got Kristen Stewart walking up to these gates. It's called Personal Shopper. Maybe it's this meditation on celebrity and fame and isolation. And obviously Kristen Stewart would be perfect for that because she's a superstar. And then she walks up to these gothic gates, and in these blood red letters it just says Personal Shopper. And it all comes rushing back that this is actually, of course, a ghost story in a horror film. Mm. And I love that as a nice little surprise. And so the whole film just kept me riding that wave of nice surprise throughout the whole time.
Yeah. I kept trying to understand, like, what's the genre or what is this film, because I didn't know much about it before I watched it. But it kept, like, it didn't go the way I thought it would be, and the genre seemed to, like, blend a bit, because it's not, I don't think it's just, like, a horror film.
No,
it's just, like, you know.
You look up any review or definition of the film on Wikipedia or IMDb or something, it's a psychological thriller, it's a ghost story, it's a horror film, it can be any number of things. At no point do you feel that there is one set genre that this film is.
Yeah. It could also be a drama.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's 100% drama. Yeah.
I think I really enjoy how modern it is and how contemporary it is, and I'd be really interested to see how it ages. I think that would be a really interesting thing to in 10 years' time to go back, because so much of it is on a phone, and so much of it is sort of international travel, and that is a really sort of like of the moment thing, like people sort of travelling for work. That wasn't like as a not a massively well paid person and still being able to do it.
Yeah.
So it just feels incredibly like of its time, and I think that's really interesting to bring that to sort of a modern sort of horror ghost story type film.
A lot of the time horror films do feel like period pieces,
yes,
don't they?
Yeah.
Even if they are modernized, they tend to be a closed setting or something like that.
Technology fails or, you know,
exactly.
Whatever.
I actually spoke to Olivier Assayas, the director of the film, about this very thing and about the reception that the film got at Cannes when it was booed, but then he won Best Director and then he got 5-star reviews, and dealing with that, and also the choice of the title card, which I loved, and all of that is in the interview with him that we've got, which I'll be playing right now. So we are delighted to be joined by Olivier Assayas, director of Personal Shopper, on the Curzon Film Podcast this week. How are you doing today, Olivier?
Good, thank you.
Excellent. And you've just given us an intro to the film at Curzon Soho, with a wonderful intro, with a wonderful answer to the question, more than we expected. And so I'm hoping that we can get just the same now. And so with the film, with people saying it's a ghost story or a horror film or a psychological thriller, there's a lot of different definitions for it. With any of those categories, it's always the dilemma between the unseen and the seen as to what is actually going to strike fear or dread for people. When you're creating the film, where did that dilemma come for you?
Well, it's... I'm trying to first draw a straight line, and this movie ultimately can be summed up as some sort of coming of age story. You know, I focus on characters. I make character driven movies, even if they turn out, you know, weird sometimes. But I think, you know, I think that what makes all the dots connect is that we are following this character who has to, Maureen, this young American girl in Paris, who basically has to reconstruct her life after the devastating loss of her twin brother. And but the thing is that I don't want to tell that story in a superficial way. I'm trying to be able to capture what is going on within her on many different levels, and it's also in that sense a movie very much about solitude, because she's a stranger in a strange land, doesn't have that many friends, doesn't belong there, but simultaneously it's modern solitude in a sense that it's an ultra connected solitude, and she's a psychic, she's a medium, so she's waiting for a sign to come basically out of nowhere, so she lives in a world that's populated by she's ultra sensitive to what is happening around her, and she reacts to signs, eventually signs that are not from her brother. She's waiting for a sign from her brother, but signs coming from all around her. So it's ultimately what I am trying to say is that I don't approach movie making in terms of genre. I use genre elements when I need, you know, them, the same way as a painter would splash a color on a canvas because he needs that color at that specific point. He doesn't need to paint the whole canvas red. So, you know, I'm trying to use the full language of cinema. I'm trying not to limit myself to a simple syntax. I'm trying to use all the colors that are available when you're telling a story, and hopefully they help me connect in a deeper way with that character.
And I think a lot of the time with a genre film like this, the horror aspect of it may well be, at the end of it, you're thinking, oh, it's metaphorical completely, or it is physical. But this film never draws a line between either, which is something I really liked about it.
What was interesting for me was to make a film in a space where there are doors between visible and invisible, and the characters circulate through those doors, and I kind of established it very early in the film, and it's really the major difference between other movies I made, because I've made other movies which dealt with genre elements in many ways. Here, it's about imagining a world which is pretty much like our world, but where eventually you have access to somewhere else, which can be eventually your own subconscious. It's eventually a dialogue you're having with yourself, but in ways we don't exactly have that dialogue, at least not that openly.
Yeah, and you mentioned doors there. There's one of my favorite bits, just in terms of a basic horror convention, is the sequence where just elevator doors and then the door of a building open and no one's there. And that's such a basic horror element, but it's just so satisfying at the same time. Did you find that when you're approaching those moments of convention, for you, there's a certain relish to it as well, about how you can also do...
Well, because honestly, I think it has to do with the fact that it pleases the audience, to put it that way. I think that movies have to be entertaining in a certain way, but I suppose I have a strange notion of what entertainment is, but still, I think the way the film moves and when it goes into strange direction, there is something exciting for me as a viewer. When I watch movies, and I don't know where it's going to go, and when it turns into some strange direction, I think there is something stimulating. There's something like this is not what I expect. So where are we going? And when you're watching a film, you're ready to go on a journey. And I suppose I'm playing on that desire.
And like kind of talking about subverting of where we're going to get these this kind of dread from, I never expected to be so affected by texting in a film. And it made me think that these days we almost have these kind of hundreds a day moments of the unknown, just as your phone buzzes in your pocket because you don't know what's on the end of it.
Yeah,
and the film really plays into that wonderfully.
Yeah, because we all relate to that. It's become part of our lives. I think that the whole dynamics of texting and of receiving and sending text messages is very complex, and it's become a part of who we are and how we communicate, how we stay in touch, in connection with our friends, our relatives, whatever. It's an interesting dimension of modern life. So anything that has to do with texting is pretty intimate.
And I think Maureen's closest relationship in the film is arguably with her phone.
Yes. Of course it is. I mean, she one day she told me, don't think I'm not aware that my thumbs are my co-stars.
Excellent. And kind of on that topic of technology, the film got me thinking about the fact that now and in 10, 20 years, 50 years, Facebook and Twitter are just going to be filled up with a lot of dead people now.
Yeah. Like movies.
Yeah. I wonder how you think maybe social media or technology, and how you address that in this film, how that's changed the way we maybe perceive the dead and the way we grieve.
The thing is that what I'm interested in ultimately is how the new world of communication has transformed us, has changed the human experience, you know, how it echoes with the human being and how they become different. And I genuinely think that post-digital individuals are different from pre-digital. I'm both. I'm pre-digital and post-digital, so I know. But it's... but also what I'm aware of is that nothing ages as fast as technology. And especially communication technology. So when I make a film where I use extensively text messaging and whatever, however way people interact with the internet, I know that it's going to be dated very soon because those things evolve at the speed of light. I'm also careful in that sense to keep it as clear and simple as possible, and not exactly, and to rely on very specific dynamics of what is that form of communication right now.
Because oftentimes people are so aware of technology developing, they avoid it completely.
Yeah.
And actually, when you're watching a film that is actively doing that, you're actually taken out of it a bit.
Yeah, to me it's extremely weird. You know, it's extremely weird. As a writer, it's very difficult to make a film, to create a fictional character that is not part of him defined by the way he communicates, because that's what has come to define it, a lot of social existence.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Going to Kristen Stewart and her co-star, her thumbs. So when you cast her in Clouds of Sils Maria, at the time it was just post Twilight and so considered fairly risky.
Mm.
But in the years since then, it's now no longer the case.
Yeah,
like, how do you think that perception has changed? What do you think's happened there in the public eye?
I think, you know, I've always thought Kristen was brilliant. I mean, you know, I saw her in a couple of the Twilight films, but I also saw her, you know, in this small part she had in Into the Wild, the Sean Penn film. I thought she was brilliant. I saw her in this movie on The Runaways, the band, where she was playing like a young Joan Jett. I thought she was extraordinary. I think the way she captured that kind of punk rock energy was so real. I mean, you know, for someone who wasn't not there. And I've always respected her a lot as an actress. So when I wanted to cast the character of Valentine, I mean, she was obviously my first choice. So there was no the difference is that I think I understood who Kristen really is during the process of making the film. It's when we were shooting Clouds of Sils Maria that I realized that Kristen was not just a really good actress, she was something else, that she was really unique. And I think in that sense that I've been like the right person in the right place at the right time, in a sense that I think all she needed was someone to give her the kind of space I gave her. And I gave her the kind of space an actress has in a European independent film. You know, it's just a way of making movies that is much more actor friendly than a Hollywood filmmaking, where she has been kind of stuck. So all of a sudden, you know, I am the one who has been able to tell her it's okay to be yourself. You know, it's you don't. I'm not interested in you as an actress. I'm interested in you as a person, so you can play with that. And so all of a sudden, you know, she. I think it kind of lit the spark, and she realized that yes, it was okay to do that, and she enjoyed it. She enjoyed it, and also I think working with Juliette Binoche was a part of it. I think she admired Juliette, and one of the reasons she wanted to make Clouds of Sils Maria is because she wanted to work with Juliette, because just to understand how she works and how she manages to have that kind of freedom, so I think she learned a lot, and I think that people through that part saw someone they were familiar with, but ultimately did not know. Mm. And all of a sudden, they realized she was actually likable, which is because, you know, she had this image like she would never smile and she's kind of sulking, and so, you know, there was that distance. But ultimately, I think I think that Kristen is really shy, and again, you know, no one gave her a chance. So I was lucky to be the one who gave her that chance.
And you mentioned that when working with her, you're trying to get her to be herself.
Mm.
And I wonder how much that helped in this role, in that she's kind of got, as the personal shopper, she has a kind of a unique relationship with celebrity, mm-hmm. in that instance.
Yeah.
With it. She's kind of on the fringe of it,
yeah.
perpetually, but yeah. never really accessing it.
Yeah.
And I imagine Kristen had a unique approach herself to that.
Well, yes, I mean, it's. I think that what I've been doing is... I mean, in both movies, I mean, looking back on it, the fact is that, you know, again, I'm not interested in Kristen, the movie star. I'm not interested in Kristen, like, the superstar. I'm interested in Kristen, the person. So somehow, in both movies, I have to take the burden of stardom off her back and throw it on someone else. So all of a sudden, the stardom is somewhere in the film, but not with her. And so eventually, it helps you know, the audience to connect with someone who is as natural and simple as Kristen can be.
And so Kristen's character Maureen, there's a really lovely bit in the film where she watches a film with this kind of useful transcription from a spirit that says, "Stars pull me up, coffin nails grab onto my feet." I mean, how do you feel that little or sentence there interprets the dead and the living for you in this film?
Well, I think that there are two moments where I needed to validate her quest. I mean, in the sense that she's this young girl who maybe she thinks she may be a medium, but is not so sure of it. She has a lot of insecurities, and I think that I needed in this film to give some kind of higher meaning to what she was doing through questioning how art can connect with the invisible. In the sense that she's an artist in the film, and take, you know, and pick examples from the recent past to share how great artists have connected with the world of the spirits. Mm. And so early in the film, there is Hilma af Klint, who is this Swedish painter from the beginning of the 20th century, who invented, who was one of the inventors of abstract art, and who was convinced that her hand was guided by spirits, and she made those beautiful, luminous, emotional canvases, but she was so scared of the result that she hid them and basically never showed them in her lifetime. And 50 years earlier, Victor Hugo, the great novelist, while in exile on the Jersey Island, became obsessed with communicating with the spirits and would hold seances every evening. He wrote transcripts of the seances, which were conversations with spirits and spirits of great men from the past. I mean, like, you know, he was having conversation with Shakespeare, Molière, Socrates, Jesus, whatever. And it sounds kind of nutty, but at the same time, he was, I suppose, that he was in touch with his own imagination, with his own subconscious, and it was more like automatic writing. And when you read those transcripts that are collected in this book, it's beautiful poetry, and I used that specific. The scene I injected into the film is a very faithful recreation of a Victor Hugo séance. I mean, you have descriptions of who was attending. He transcribes the dialogue with the spirit and so on and so forth. So it's I chose this moment because of the beauty of the words of the poetry, which supposedly comes from the spirit, but ultimately is Victor Hugo's writing.
Amazing. Wow. Mm. I just wanted to ask you about the reception that the film received at Cannes, because there was the initial booing, but then obviously you won Best Director and get 5-star reviews.
Mm.
How do you even begin to kind of comprehend that?
Well, yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Honestly, you know, I've done everything. I've been in Cannes like a million times. I was there as a young cinephile. I was there as a journalist. I was there as a screenwriter as well. I was there as a short film director. I was there in fringe selections as a director. I've been in competition many times. So I kind of know Cannes inside out. And the number one rule is expect anything to happen. You know, it's just you have no idea. You don't know. So it's rule number two. Do your best to bring your film to Cannes because it's the best audience for any film, whatever happens. And so yeah, I mean, you know, it's because it's Cannes is exciting, Cannes is fun, Cannes can be extremely tough, but it's alive, it's like vibrant. And I've never really made movies trying to be consensual or try to, you know, to do things. You know, in Cannes, don't bring a movie with genre elements. Just don't do that. You know, they feel it like it's a provocation, which it is ultimately. But still, you know, what I'm saying, it's rough, but it's exciting, it's fun, and in the end, possibly they give you a prize. So you know what's wrong with it.
Excellent. There's a question here that's more maybe just a bit for me than maybe our general listeners. Although it's only on screen for obviously a couple of seconds, I really loved the title card and the placement of it in the film.
The
title, when it comes up, Personal Shopper.
Oh, yeah.
And it just felt like the actual kind of graphic design of it, the font choice, everything. Mm. It's like sleek, modern, minimal, but then it's this... the text before it has all been white, and then you just get this lovely kind of shocking blood red.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether you could give me any insight into like picking titles and like whether you've got to try and think of your film. And
yeah, it's when I was filming that shot, I had no idea. I was not sure I would use it as I had no idea where the credits would be, if I would use it for the credits. But then you know, after when I was in the editing room, I realized, well, you know, this, you have this car approaching the gate opening. Why not put the title on the opening of the gate? You know, it could work. Yeah, but it's very I'm very basic with those things. And I wanted the title to be read. I remember, you know, my editor asked me, why do you want red? I mean, it doesn't read that well. Yeah, but it kind of brings that kind of genre element.
Yeah.
To it. So that was part of it. No, the only thing is that we tried different fonts, as we always do. We ended up with that one, and it kind of grew. It was very small at the beginning. And gradually it became very big.
Yeah, I love how it just completely fills the screen.
Yeah.
I saw it at London Film Festival, and it started at something like 8:30 in the morning. Mm. So getting that was like a nice cup of coffee, that giant screen filling red type. Anyway, we're probably close to the end. So last question: have you ever seen a ghost?
No, I have not seen a ghost, but I think they are around us. I mean, I think we all live with our own ghosts. I think if you are. I think it's a strange way of. Ghosts, the way I see it, they are a projection of us, of things that we are not completely conscious of, but we need to project. That's why we feel them. Mm. That's why they produce this kind of anxiety or tension. So in that sense, you know, I think. There's ghosts. We all have ghosts.
Excellent. Olivier Assayas, thanks a lot for joining us. Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
So there we are, Olivier Assayas. They're talking about Personal Shopper just after a Q&A at Curzon Soho. He was on very, very good form. And as you can tell, he's very happy to expand on his answers and give you as much information as you like. I think his 1 minute intro for the film ended up being about 7. But very, very cool guy, and pulls off a old man cardigan excellently.
As do you, Jake.
Thank you.
As
well, I'm not wearing one.
Just generally.
Yeah. I do have the one cardigan that.
And you look damn fine in it.
Thank you.
They can't see it, but you look fine in it.
Thank you. Going back to the film. So we've got Kristen Stewart kind of beginning the film in this old house that her brother died in or was resident in and then died. And she's going back to it to try and communicate with him. Mm. I really loved this kind of opening seance almost of her trying to communicate with this house, because unlike a lot of horror films, she actually is willing the horror to happen.
Yeah, I think she was because they're trying to sell the house to some friends, just trying to get rid of whatever spirit there is in there.
Mm.
So that's, I thought that was quite interesting that she's taking on that because her brother obviously lived there, her twin brother, and she's taking on the role to like get rid of that spirit.
Mm. And it happens quite early on in the film, so I don't think it would be a spoiler to say there is a spirit in the house, but it's perhaps not the one that we expect it to be as well. It's just a ghostly old woman figure the rendering of the ghosts in this are really lovely, actually. They've got this cloudy, flowery liquidiness to them as well that maybe we've seen in the likes of Crimson Peak or The Devil's Backbone.
But more subtly done.
They're very thin, aren't they? They're almost made of cling film as well.
Quite photographic as well.
And from that began my biggest surprise with the film as a whole. When we go into these horror films of late where they're trying to subvert the genre but also be sincere with it as well, they often draw a line of between the metaphorical and the literal. And so I think of the witch. In the first scene of The Witch, we're shown the witch exists and that is real.
Yeah.
And then maybe think of something like The Orphanage or The Babadook, where by the end of the film you're thinking it's a metaphorical horror, isn't it? It's a metaphorical ghost or a monster.
Yeah, it's done for another reason.
Yeah. And Personal Shopper never buys into either side of that. And there are things that are real that we can actually see and are given physical evidence of. But then there's stuff that we don't, and through this texting as well that she's perpetually doing with someone we don't really know, there is this blurred line between what is metaphorical, what's literal, and what we should really be defining as the monster on each side.
I also found quite interesting how she took the whole situation very normally. So she was not questioning the fact about spirits or her being able to speak to spirits or anything like that. She just took it normally, and everyone around her seemed to.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
I think he mentions in the interview that this world is just has slightly more open doors, and so that when she says that's what she does, and the way that she approaches those seances or whatever they're called, really, that there is a sense of that's perfectly acceptable thing to be doing. So, Kristen Stewart, in this, we touched on the fact that when she was casting Clouds of Sils Maria, which was Assayas's previous film, she was just off the back of Twilight, and it was a risky move at the time to consider her for a smaller indie art house picture. And in the 3 or 4 years since then, that's no longer the case. It was no longer a risky move to cast Kristen Stewart in your more challenging, quieter, slower role.
No, well, we talked about it the other week with certain women, and you know, you just expect to see her in these kind of films now, and you expect her to give a good performance, and more than that, you expect her to actually hold a film together.
Mm.
Yeah.
And she has, I think, actually something like Twilight gives you that ability that she's had to hold a whole franchise on her back while people have a go at her for like every little move she does and saying she's not a very good actress and everything like that. So actually an indie film where it's maybe not getting as much press coverage, or it's maybe not being seen, unfortunately, by as many people, means that she has the gravity to say, well, you know, I've held something like Twilight and got through that and held on to that. Of course I can hold this film.
Yeah.
Of course I can be the star of this film, but not overdo it and not be too big on the screen and not be... There's never, especially with this film, with Personal Shopper, there's never a bit where you think she's being the big star of the film. It just feels like she's being an ordinary woman that is just trying to work out what's going on in her world. And actually she plays, you know, it's interesting having the character that she's shopping for, having that sort of big prima donna celebrity, and then having her go against that, because that's really interesting from her point of view, because she would be seen as that big celebrity that would have a personal shopper. So it's interesting that she's playing the personal shopper.
Yeah, and I think that gives her a more of a unique insight into that role. And so let's talk about Kyra, this celebrity that Kristen Stewart's Maureen works for. And she's this periphery figure that is such a ginormous presence and is key to the entire film that we don't really see that often at all, and we see Maureen attempting to kind of vicariously live through her at points. She stays in her apartment or hotel, or tries on her dresses and literally does her shopping for her as well, so knows what's in her grocery bag. And as we said with Marlon Brando, that's a great way to learn about someone. And I think she's a really interesting figure. And initially, we think that's a periphery story, and the kind of brother in the ghost story is the key thing that we're looking at. And maybe about a third of the way through, we start to shift, and Kyra and Maureen and the relationship with Kyra's ex-boyfriend, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Becomes this midway point Hitchcockian thriller for a bit as well, which begins this remarkable sequence in the centre of the film, in which texting becomes the most gripping thing.
I couldn't look at my phone for a while afterwards, just because it's not just texting though, it's the amount of text, and it's that waiting for the next text, and it's seeing what the character is going to respond and how she's going to respond to these texts. And it's that sort of idea that your phone has its own life and has its own ability to shape your life, and that's the really scary thing, because it's taking something that's incredibly modern, and like you can pretty much be contacted anywhere now, and it's interesting that she, you know, she gets on the Eurostar and is still texting and things like that.
Yeah, that sequence was lovely, I thought. Yeah. And the timing with it, because she's just on the train and travelling from one place to the other whilst texting. And I just thought that was so brilliant and didn't expect it to be that well done.
It's not often we see it, because technology moves so fast, it's the easiest way to date your film. And particularly with texting and recognisable software that we see every day, multiple times, even 100 times a day. Mm. And so actually having that in front of us, even though it will be probably new software within 6 months, a year, in this moment, that feels so real, doesn't it?
I think also the idea of texting now is that everyone does it. And I don't think that's necessarily going to go away. In the sort of, it might be a slightly different form, but it's still going to be a message going from one person, or hopefully one person, to another. So I think actually it might not date as much as we think, because it's still, that idea of messaging isn't going to go away. And also at the moment you have that sort of instant speed of messaging as well, which I think is so important with that sequence, that you do receive message instantly. It's not like you have to wait a couple of minutes for a text message to send.
Definitely. And then, as you say, she's on a train. She's going to pick up a dress in London for Kyra, and she goes out of reception and then comes back into the country again. And then you get this flood of messages, and that's maybe the biggest scare in the whole film as well. Just so horrible. And it does make you think about the fact that each time you get a text and your phone buzzes in your pocket, just what that could be, and you have that brief half second, 1 second moment where you have that unknown quantity that is just sitting there waiting to be answered.
I thought it was interesting that she was replying to the text. I mean, because obviously, I don't know, like, if someone that I don't know was sending me the text that she received, I wouldn't reply.
These are intense messages that we are given to. They're quite violent at times, and they're voyeuristic, and they come from a place that give us the dilemma of who it may be and where these messages are coming from, whether they're coming from a real person, whether they're coming from someone like her brother.
I think that's why she replies.
Yeah,
because she doesn't know, and it's that. A lot of the film is quite hopeful, and like she goes into the house initially to contact her brother in the hope that will sort of release him and release sort of the burden from her. And I think that's why she replies to the text messages, because she's hoping that something will happen, something bigger will happen. And it's this sort of idea of the sort of, a lot of what she does is incredibly mundane. But it's that sort of idea that there is something bigger and something greater out there, and that's why I think she replies at a certain point.
Yeah, but I think at some point that shifts a bit, because I think the person that's texting her is like, "Oh, I want you."
Yeah.
And then I think it becomes a bit more clear that it's not her brother, and I think then it becomes like a bit of her understanding what she wants. And I think because he was questioning of who she is and what she does, then it's more of like, oh, you're scared, you want this, you want that, and it becomes more like a personal discovery kind of.
Yeah, and it is in some way a coming of age film for her.
Mm.
She is a stranger in a strange land, and she's lost maybe the closest person that she has to her in that space, and it's complete isolation. And her relationship with her phone is something that allows her to communicate, but also creates a humongous distance. If we think of her boyfriend, who we only ever see through Skype as well, and the dresses that that she puts on, and we have those intimate moments where we see her changing, but she's trying on something that's not hers.
Mm-hmm.
And she's perpetually in this state of removal from herself, and all her relationships are not directly with her either.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as the film goes on, it's not damning of technology, really. I think at times technology can be a great way of keeping in touch with people, whoever they may be, but as the film goes on, she doesn't necessarily accept her isolation, but begins to develop along from to be in the now and in the present, as opposed to constantly defining herself by the more distant relationships and things that have happened in the past for her as well.
Yeah.
Thinking of how the film itself has been made, it's got this kind of woozy, floating-y, voyeuristic, ghost-like camera at times, which I think really makes a wonderful atmosphere in a number of the scenes, because particularly in horror films there are conventions and stipulations in editing that we grow to understand of when something's going to cut away and when it's not. And because the filmmakers need to hide something from the audience to maintain that reality.
It never feels like things are being hidden by the camera work. And I think, there are actual points where we see certain things, and deliberately so. There's never that quick cut from one scene to another, from her face to, to something else, to them flicking. Because it's not that. It's not trying to scare you. It's not trying to sort of have scare after scare after scare after scare. Because I think that's probably where horror needs to sort of go down that route now. Because it's done so many of those quick sort of slasher, quick cut movies. That actually it's nice to have one that invites you in. And almost you sort of go along with her. Where you're like, I'm wanting to see the ghost. I'm wanting to see what is out there.
Mm.
And I don't think you're necessarily terrified by it. You're almost half welcoming it. And something like, it's interesting because then something like text messaging, like we were just talking about, suddenly is the scary thing and not the ghost. And
yeah.
I think that's really interesting.
And it reminds me of, we mentioned already, The Devil's Backbone and a lot of Guillermo del Toro's ghost stories, in that the monsters are the people and the ghosts are just as human as anyone else.
Yeah.
And I think it's perhaps true of this film too. There is actually a really lovely bit of camera work with the elevator doors and the hotel doors that are mentioned in the interview, when they just open by themselves, and there's no cut into a close-up to hide how they're doing it. It's just this lovely wide shot, and it's all open, and they're glass doors as well, so you can't see anyone how they're doing it. It's just so satisfying to see just exactly what cinema can do in create wonderfully simple illusions, and it's just really satisfying to see that happen. Even if it's just quite a basic trick, and I'm sure it'd be like any magic trick, it'd be very disappointing to find out how it was done, but it was quite fun.
There's a little compartment for the rabbit.
And that it does play with the convention throughout the film, and that's what Asayas said about why this film got booed at Cannes. Because he said that if you're doing anything with any genre, then you're going to get booed. Like if you're not wholly original. But I enjoyed it, and I will happily, happily watch this film again.
Definitely.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. Right, so, spoiler stuff. If you haven't watched the film yet, please stop listening now and return to us when you have. We've got a few final act things just to quickly brush over, and then we will get into other recommendations for the week and what else is out available in cinemas and on Curzon Home Cinema for you to watch. So, what do we think about the ending of the film?
I love the change of location.
Mm.
I thought that was a really interesting choice to go to take her somewhere else and take her somewhere sort of a non-Western place, because that's sort of almost weirdly that feels more spiritual, if you know what I mean by that. That seems to have that, still has that sort of tradition of sort of the dead and respecting the dead. So I think it's really interesting that shift in location that the director chooses to take her on.
Yeah, and it's also a bit like it kind of will always follow her, and that she can't run from it, and I don't think she chooses to run from it. It's just there.
And I think that's what the film's comment on grief really is. That you have this kind of intense desire just after the point of death to find someone and find that person and find them whole and communicate with them, and it's coming to realise that you're never going to have that two-way conversation again, but they are still there. And I think that's the point that Maureen gets to at the end, that she has her own personal ownership of what that person is, and she can hold on to that. And even if that person is there, they can't communicate back with her properly anyway. And at times, the way that the dead communicate with us through grief and memory is violent and loud, but also in this film it's quite tender and it's quiet and it's subtle, and it's just in the background, and it can create a smile and a memory, and it's actually quite lovely too.
Also, it's nice that it doesn't have a big ending. There's not a big reveal, or there's not a, as you sort of said before, it sort of has that, it's on the lines of sort of two sort of, not genres, two sort of whether it's theoretical or whether it's in reality, and it never decides what it's going to be, and by the end it sort of just leaves it on quite a quiet note, which is lovely.
And there is a very small hint of a ghostly figure in the kitchen, which gives us all as much proof as you could want or not want
about the reality
of this film, which is great. So Personal Shopper is out now. Do go and check it out. It's a really brilliant film. Also out this week is Asghar Farhadi's new film, The Salesman, which is just off the back of winning the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. I think a lot of the time we were thinking it was going to be Tony Erdmann, but then there was the travel ban, of course, that was introduced, and Farhadi himself couldn't attend the foreign language film, and the tides kind of turned, and we knew that the Academy Awards were going to be a very politically aligned ceremony, and then The Salesman ended up winning, which I think is really great. And I think it's brilliant to see a film coming out of an awards ceremony like that with such a statement behind it. And this led to the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, putting on a free public show of the film on Oscar night, which was such a brilliant idea. And if you don't know Farhadi, you may know his one of his previous films, A Separation, from 2012, which again, Academy Award for Foreign Language Film. And that is a remarkable film, and one of Daniela's favourites as well.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. It's about a couple going through a divorce, and it's so subtly done, and it's all about them, how they're dealing with it, and especially in the society that they are in, and how the kids are dealing it, and people around them, and it's just so subtle and so beautiful.
And it's got a really, really beautiful final shot and credit roll. That it makes you think, why do other films not try their hardest to make the use of all the screen time that they have, even whilst the credits are playing? It's a remarkable final shot. So for Hardy's The Salesman, that's out now, and that's on Curzon Home Cinema as well as being in cinemas. So do check that out. A wildly important film with so much already recent history and context behind it. So really do seek that one out. Also in cinemas still, we've got we've still got Logan, which I think is really good fun, as well as being a neat twist on the recent city exploding superhero films that we've had.
Yeah, it's not buildings up falling down with Logan. I'd like to say Moonlight's still out. If you haven't seen it, we talk about it pretty much every week. Do go see it. There's a recent one, Best Picture. It's really good. And if you want to find out more about it, you can also listen to our podcast about it as well, which is really good.
Our podcast with Oscar-winning writer of Moonlight, Tarryl Alvin McCraney. Yes, we've got that. We can say that, guys. Right, and there's a few things on Curzon Home Cinema to check out if you've enjoyed Personal Shopper. So Clouds of Sils Maria, Olivier Assayas's previous film, also starring Kristen Stewart and Juliette Binoche. Do please check that one out. It's brilliant. And also on Curzon Home Cinema is Anne Fontaine's film, The Innocents, which our very own Sam Howlett did an interview with her a while back, which is on the Curzon blog if you want to check it out. But I'm highlighting The Innocents as a companion piece to Ida, which was on Film 4 for the first time last night. And my dad texted me about The Innocents, and he said he went to see this last night. Excellent. In essence, a philosophy essay played against the backdrop of the Second World War in Eastern Europe, delivered as a philosophy lecture should be, without competing claims turning up without warning. Yes, we are drawn to sympathise with the Mother Superior and her self-damning existential acts and her own internally imposed torture. A film that was confident in its own belief to allow for the possibility of both redemption and isolation. So that's a jolly romp. Anne Fontaine's The Innocents. But do check that one out too.
He's going to be replacing me next week on the Curzon podcast.
Yeah. But I think that is all we've got time for. So thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to CSR for letting us use their studio as usual. And goodbye from Harry Chapman.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Daniela Verricktonidi.
Goodbye.
And goodbye from the personally shocking Jake Cunningham. Goodbye.